was pleased. Oh, we're going to start right now, basically.
Hello, everyone. We're going to get started now with the forum on DNS abuse. My name is Margie Milam, and I'm going to introduce our moderator, Andre Philippe from the CZ NIC, who's going to be our moderator for the session and give you more information on what to expect. Andre?
Okay, so welcome, everyone. I think we had a lot of very interesting talks about how to create internet, how to build new domains and things like that. And you know, now we should realize that the internet is not just for the good guys, but we should also keep in mind that there are some bad guys here. So this session is going to be about the DNS abuse, one of the dark sides of the internet and of the open cyberspace. And we will have a panel discussion on this topic. Close to my right hand side, there are four very knowledgeable and good presence in this area, expert in this area. And we're going to have three presentations. First one will be held by Martin Peterka, the second one by Branko Stamenkovic, and the third one will be by two Christophers, Christopher Mellon and Christopher Landy. So the first speech will be given by Martin Peterka. Martin is a colleague of mine. He is an operating officer of the company, and more importantly, he's a head of Czech National CERT.cz, so he will share some experience in this local country, how we deal with DNS abuse and what we can do about it, and how we cooperate with the foreign agencies and law enforcement and things like that. So, Martin, please start.
Good afternoon. Thank you. That you introduced me. Okay. Today, I would say a few sentences about our association, about CZNIC, introduce you our security teams which we operate, and describe you two of interesting incidents which our team solved in the past. At the end of my presentation, I would like to introduce you our malicious domain manager, which is software which we use as our proactive tool. So let me start with CZNIC. CZNIC is an association. We were founded in 1998 year by 12 leading Czech ISPs. And because we have open membership, number of members grew during the years, and now we have more than 100 members. Today we have more than 50 employees, and our core business is operating of .cz domain registry. Based on this role, we are part of state's critical infrastructure, and we have signed a memorandum of understanding with Czech government, which relates to this role, and a second memorandum of understanding with Czech National Security Agency, which focused on our role in National CSERT team of Czech Republic. I'll speak about it. We are a non-profit organization, and we have a variety of other activities. For example, we have our own education center, or we have a department, CZNIC Laboratories, which develop on software. And, of course, we have security teams. Officially, in CZNIC, we have two security teams. First of them is an internal team. CZNIC CERT, which has two main roles. First of them is incident handling within our own autonomous system. Because we do not have customers, our autonomous systems is in fact only our own network, so this role is quite simple. We usually do not have incidents, so there are no problems. But the second role of our CZNIC CERT team is much more important from our point of view because it is relates to .cz registry. Our team is able to deactivate a domain which has harmful content. We speak about viruses, we speak about malware, we speak about phishing sites or center of botnets, and if we find the sites with this harmful content, we are able to deactivate this domain for 1 month, and if it is necessary, we can do it repeatedly. Second security team which we operate is national CSER team, it's CSER.cz. We operated from start of 2011 year till the end of 2010. Team was operated by academic association CESNET based on a grant with Ministry of Interior. This grant ended at the end of 2000 year, and CZNIC agreed that we will continue with operation of this team. So we started day-by-day operation 1st of January 2011, and together with it, we started the transfer of agenda from CESNET Association. This transfer ended during the May last year, so since June 2011, we are in full operation. Of course, we closely cooperate with colleagues from CESNET still. Our main role is incident handling and reporting, and I believe I can say we are very successful in it, but we also do proactive steps. For example, in the second half of last year, we analyzed data from our authoritative DNS servers for the CZ domain, found unsecured DNS resolvers with static ports, and prepared a special letter which we sent to administrators of these servers with explanation of the problem, and we offered them help. Because some of these resolvers were within governmental networks, we cooperate in this project with Czech Security Information Service. Our team have other activities. For example, we organize community meetings, workshops for community, and we have a special courses which are focused on security in our education center. Abroad, we cooperate with international organizations. We cooperate with Terena, with FIRST, ENISA, and, for example, with Team Camry, maybe you will know him, and some other. CSER.cz is accredited by Terena Trusted Introducer from October 2011. Where are some statistics of the team? You can find them at our webpage if you are interested in it. Maybe you can see that the most of incidents which we solve are from our intrusion detection system. From the rest, the most of them are phishing sites. Now let me say something about two incidents which we solved in the past. First of them is quite new. Our CSER.cz team solved it in the start of June this year, and it was a DNS amplification attack. Second one will be a little bit older. I will speak about a massive phishing attack which solved our CZNIC CERT in 2010. We'll start with DNS amplification. Target of this attack was one of the Latvian banks, and the attack went through thousands of open relay DNS servers from all over the world. Most of them were from United States, but a couple of thousand were in Europe, and 170 of them were from Czech Republic. So our team solved this problem at the request of Latvian CSER team, which sent us relevant data. So we sorted them, found information about administrators, and contact them and ask them for correction. This attack ended during a few days, as usual, but for us it's still in progress because we are still in touch with administrators and try to help them with fixing their problem. Today it looks that at about 50% of this DNS are fixed. By the way, we were interested in name servers which were involved in this attack, and we compared them with name servers which we communicated last year in case of static ports, and so we compared with two lists, and we found that a few of them, five or six, were at both lists. So, well, anyway, let's go to phishing attack from 2010 year. This attack started with complaint from one of our registrars, which registered a few domains to different foreign holders, to different domain name servers, etc., but all of them were paid by stolen credit card. It's something what's not really usual in Czech, so we did some investigation and found that at these sites is a Trojan horse. This Trojan horse was part of attack to Internal Revenue Service, which is a U.S. government organization for taxes. And this Trojan horse looked like some application which you need to run if you want to fix some mistakes in your tax application. During next 5 days, were registered 150 domains which have this Trojan horse. Together with experts from IRS and registrars, our team was able to deactivate it, all this domain, and I must say we did it very quickly. Most of them were deactivated within 1 hour after registration. I guess it's quite a good time. Result was that after 5 days, attackers stopped registration in .cz registry and moved to another one. So we can say we were successful. But when we discussed this problem, we decided that it's not enough to be prepared to incident. We need to be more proactive and try to find problems before there will be an incident. So together with our CZNIT laboratories, we prepared a special software, which we called Malicious Domain Manager. This software takes data from a few public sources which are focused to store data about malware and phishing and other harmful content. We use Malware Patrol, Fish Tank, Zeus Tracker, and a few other sources to this application. So we take this data, select from them sites and sources within .cz domain, and search contact data for these domains. And because our application is connected with ticket system, our experts are able to communicate with these administrators and these contacts and check if they repaired these sites, if they fixed the problems. We started this application last June, so now it's running for 1 year, and there are some results. During this 1 year, we are very proud that we helped with cleaning of more than 11,000 pages, which were in more than 2,000 domains. At this chart, you can see data from Fish Tank, where a percentage of phishing pages within .cz between June and December 2011. You can see that there is a big drop from 6% in June to 2% in December. This chart doesn't continue because Fish Tank shows only data about countries which are above 2%. So I'm pretty sure it wasn't only because of our malicious domain manager, but I believe we helped them. This application is open source, so if you are interested to download and use it, you can do it. At the slide is a link to this project. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Martin. So well done indeed. It was a presentation, you know, from the CCTLD registry. We will not take any question directly after the presentation. There will be time after all of them are finished. So without wasting time, I would like to ask the next speaker, Branko Staminkovic, to deliver his presentation. Reading his bio would probably take another presentation, so I will not read it all. He has been involved in many cybercrime projects, either nationally in Serbia at European level or internationally, and his affiliation is head of Special Public Prosecutor's Office for High-Tech Crime of Serbia. So, Stanko, please.
Thank you, Chair, very much. Let me just see. Okay. So, as Chair said, my name is Branko Stamenković. I'm the head of the Special Prosecutor's Office for Cybercrime. It is on? It should be on, yeah. Okay. Sound better, I believe. Okay, thank you. So, my name is Branko Stojanković. I'm the head of the Special Prosecutor's Office for Cybercrime of Serbia. And yes, I'm government, and even worse, I am the part of the criminal justice government. And I believe that this first time, which is going to be for me, this ICANN meeting, for which I have to thank Margie and good people from the ICANN, you're going to be, let's say, benevolent to me, because at this moment I have to share in my presentation, let's say, three levels of what at this moment is going on when it comes to the tackling of the cybercrime in the world, on the local level, and then in the third part, some of the cases which we encountered in Serbia. So on the global level, we have one tool when it comes to the tackling of the cybercrime, and it's only tool at this moment, and that's the Cybercrime Convention of the Council of Europe, CETS 185, or popularly called the Budapest Convention, which was signed and opened for the signatures in 2001. And so far, 47 states from all over the world signed or ratified this convention, with the prospect of many more joining the Cybercrime Convention. What's very interesting about this convention is that it belongs to the Council of the Europe as the organization of the European states, but it's open for the ratification and before that signatory by all the countries all around the world. As you can see, Serbia ratified that convention in 2005, signed in 2005, ratified in 2009, and put into the force as well in 2009. United States signed in 2001, ratified in 2006, and put into the force in 2007. This tool brings let's say, the U.S. authorities and the, let's say, Serbian authorities in one joint force for committing cybercrime all over the world. Summary of the treaty. The convention is the first international treaty on crimes committed by the internet and other computer networks, dealing particularly with infringements of copyright, computer-related fraud, child pornography, and violations of network security. It also contains a series of powers and procedures such as the search of computer networks and interception. You can see on the screen that the cyberspace criminal conducts, which are envisaged by the Cybercrime Convention, are divided in four groups. First is defenses against the confidentiality, integrity, and availability of computer data and systems. Then computer-related forgery and fraud. Then content-related offenses, such as child pornography, xenophobia, and racism. And fourth, offenses related to intellectual property rights and similar rights, plus the combination of offenses such as spam, phishing, ID theft, botnets, terrorist use of ICT, and so forth and so on.
When it comes to the offenses against the confidentiality, integrity, and availability of computer data and systems, which in a broader sense DNS abuse falls to, there is illegal access to computer system, illegal interception, data interference, system interference, and misuse of devices. And it, in its scope, the Budapest Convention tools are in the criminalizing conduct within the substantive law as illegal access, criminal acts of the illegal access, illegal interception, data interference, system interference, misuse of devices, fraud and forgery, child pornography, and IPR offenses. And then we have the procedural tools, which are the expedite preservation, search and seizure, and interception of the computer data. So every country which signed or ratified on the end this convention has to have within the local legal framework, the legal framework of that country, all those substantive and procedural law tools embedded into the law system, which on the end of the day will make all the criminal authorities, criminal tackling authorities when it comes to the cybercrime in the world, on the same page and with the same tools, easing us our line of the work when it comes to the tackling of the cybercrime. Then on the local level, we have the Serbian example, which started back in the 90s. And one of the very important tasks which we had in front of us was on the national level. So fortunately enough, the government of the Republic of Serbia and the Ministry for the Digital Agenda during the 2010 and 2011 adopted the national strategy for the development of the information society, which is the key document when it comes to the organization of the protection of the internet and cyberspace when it comes to the Serbia on the level of the state. As you can see, national strategy for the development included the gain of the trust of the citizens and other users in the secure functioning of the ICT systems and security of the personal data in those systems, awareness widening about necessity of using the information security measures, protection of the data, and so forth and so on. What is, let's say, specific about my country is that in very early stage, we understood the necessity to have the specialized government authorities for combating cybercrime. At this moment, even on the level of the European Union, that kind of the specialization is rather rare. One of the reasons why the specialization happened in my country is that the scope and the load of the, let's say, the cyber crimes was very high during the 90s and in the beginning of the 2000s. And of course, one great, ignorance of the judicial prosecution and police system in my country led to believe that only the specialized government authorities could spearhead or could tackle this new challenge, this new threat cybercrimes which were affecting Serbia and affecting the world from Serbia by the Serbian criminals. So as you can see, the very idea began into the late 90s, and during the 2000s, in 2004, the draft law was made, proposed to the National Assembly. In 2005, the law was empowered, was adopted by the National Assembly. And from 2005 onwards until these days, we have the special law on the organization and competence of special government authorities for combating cybercrime in Serbia. That law includes organization, its procedural law, and organizational law. It's not the substantial law, and includes, in the first place, organization on three levels of the government authorities. First of all, there is a special service within the Ministry of Interior, then the Special Prosecutor's Office, and then the special chambers or special court for the cybercrime within the higher court in Belgrade. Of course, together with those government authorities, we are now on the beginning of the, let's say, forming of the national certs. At this moment, we only have the academic cert in Serbia, not the governmental one. So I hope that in time to come, in very near time to come, we are going to have this important body as well within the system of protection against the cybercrime in Serbia. Just briefly, to go through the substantial law, as you can see, we have three groups of the criminal acts, which are different by the way of the execution and on the way of the how the, let's say, criminals are acting when they are executing these criminal acts. And all I have to underline that all of those criminal acts are completely in the line with the Budapest Convention. As I already mentioned, we have the Special Prosecutor's Office. Then we have the Special Service for the Suppression of the Cybercrime within the Ministry of Interior. And then we have the organization and competence of the courts. As I already mentioned, the Specialized Chamber of Judges within the Higher Court in Belgrade is handling those cases. You can briefly see the statistical data for the Special Public Prosecution Office for combating cybercrime. At this moment, we have over 2,600 cases within, let's say, our portfolio. Now, something about the cases, and yes, the mask is there, the famous mask. This case is rather new, and this is the first case in which we encountered the anonymous organization, let's say, in Serbia, which brought our attention by the defacing and trying to get into the depth of some of the government servers. Defacing of the, namely, Ministry of Justice, the Republic Prosecutor's Office, and not only that, but some other government authorities' websites occurred. Some of the, false DNSing and some of the proxying, which were using by the anonymous proxying, was used. And on the end of the day, when the search and seizure of the premises of the, at that moment, the suspect and later the accused one, was conducted, we realized that during only, let's say, 6 months, the last 6 months of his acts, he managed to have 776,590 PHP shells seeded all over the world and in Serbia as well. What was very interesting, that only one guy with a bit of the help from the another guy, succeeded in penetrating at that moment in, 50% of the Serbian ISPs, and he took control of the route servers of those ISPs, meaning effectively that he was able to control the flow of the data on the route servers of the some of the major ISPs in Serbia. One of the big threats in Serbia as well is the abuse of the credit cards. And that abuse of the credit cards is, of course, always coming with the false identities and with the stolen identities on the internet. And by the use of the credit cards with the anonymous proxies all over the world. But some of those proxies were discovered in Serbia as well. So on the end of the execution of these criminal acts, you have always a citizen or a company, but in our case, it's mostly the citizens which are experiencing the lack of their property on their credit cards or on their debit cards. So one can imagine that this kind of the execution, the criminal acts, is very much of the danger for the, a simple man or the small man. One of the criminal cases which we encountered as well is, the internet child pornography. And internet child pornography, by the definition, is always using, the perpetrators of, that, of those criminal acts are always using the false DNSs, the anonymous proxies, the servers on the internet, or any other branch of the internet which is not that much in the controllable space by the ISPs or by the government. So when we are going for those criminal perpetrators, we have to arm ourselves with a lot of patience and a lot of knowledge and a lot of the international cooperation. At some moments, we encountered, not that good cooperation by the foreign ISPs and the foreign authorities when it comes to the tackling of this particular problem. But I have to admit that we have impeccable cooperation with the U.S. Authorities when it comes to these problematics. And I believe that danger of the internet child pornography, which is present today in the world, will wake up all those who are still sleeping in this area. This is one interesting case about the abuse of the internet domain, which was the escrowEurope.com. The false DNS and the false site was put on by the perpetrators from Serbia, which basically asked for the escrow from the boards, online boards in the U.S., which were set up for the escrow or trade of the vintage electric guitars or vintage items. And then when that kind of the execution went well for them, they even accelerated their conduct, and you're going to see now some of the items which they acquired with the execution of the criminal act over the internet. On the left side, you can see those vintage guitars ranging from $2,500 up to the $20,000. And even on the end of this action, we were able to seize Kawasaki Ninja racing bike. So this is very interesting. So this is just to picture in this world and in this moment what the perpetrators of the criminal acts are ready to do in the course of the execution of the criminal act and in order to get the financial gain. Even to transfer that motorbike from the Oregon to Belgrade using the cargo plane. And yes, always the DDoS attacks, which are very, very often and which can inflict very, very high damage, not only to the ISPs, but to the all the users of the ISPs, namely the companies and, yes, on the end of the day, the citizens or the population of some country. For example, this particular DDoS attack, which happened in Serbia, shut out the very core of the internet access in Serbia for 12 hours. So the main backbone of the communication between the providers from the outside of Serbia and main Serbian provider at that time was in jeopardy. And as I said, for 12 hours, we weren't able to have none of the traffic coming into the Serbia or going out. So, in a nutshell, yes, I'm the member of the government, and yes, I'm part of the criminal justice system. But as you can saw in my presentation, the specialization of the government authorities is a trend today. And you're going to more and more see the specialized police officers, specialized legal enforcement agencies, but not only them, because they are out there for, let's say, 10 to 15 years at this moment, but you're going to see more specialized prosecutors, you're going to see much more specialized judges, which are going to be the ones which are going to file subpoenas, which are going to ask for additional informations, and yes, which are going to go transborder. We are not going to just stay within the borders of our countries because the cybercrime is transnational crime, it's a transborder crime, and we are going to use the tools which are in our possession, such as the Budapest Convention of the Council of Europe, and ask for the information and ask for the evidence. And we are going to do that in the cooperation with our colleagues from the legal enforcement agencies, public prosecutions, and so forth and so on. Hopefully with one good goal, and that is the protection not only of our societies, but the society of the world as well. Thank you, and I'm going to wait for the questions on the end. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Marco. Perfect presentation. Another presentation will be more about investigative methodology and domain name seizures, and will be delivered by two researchers from U.S. Department of Homeland Security, I think it's Homeland Security Investigation Cybercrime Centers. And first is called Christopher Malone. He's closer to me. And the next gentleman is Christopher Lendy. So, gentlemen, please start your presentation.
Yes, thank you, Chair. And thank you, Margie, for the opportunity to present today. It's very much appreciated. As mentioned, my name is Chris Malone. I am a special agent with the Department of Homeland Security's Homeland Security Investigations, and I'm assigned to our Cybercrime Center in Washington, D.C., what we call C3. And myself, in concert with my colleague, who will introduce himself, are members of the ad hoc law enforcement advisory group to the GAC, and as many in the room will know, have advocated to that body on a number of law enforcement interest, internet governance matters, I would say public safety matters, not just law enforcement, regarding concerns of the type of the IPv6 transition, standardized record retention periods and accuracy of those records, but primarily what I'll speak to here and has been discussed over the past 48 hours is accuracy and the importance of who is data to our investigative activities. And in our capacity, in discussions with that group, members of which are present here, the FBI, DEA, Secret Service from my own country, and our foreign colleagues, SOCA and others in the UK, colleagues in the RCMP and Europol present, we share a vision of the accuracy and of this data, of the who is data and its import to our investigative activities. And in my interaction with them, we've discussed that frequently we perhaps take for granted a presumption that people understand and can intimate how we conduct our investigative activities, which seem quite obvious to us. But in thinking through this process, we're aware that sometimes folks may not know the methodologies we use to initiate and conduct cyber-based investigations. So in the light of that, I have a brief presentation touching on what may even appear some of the mundane nature of which we initiate and conduct these investigations to give you some perspective of the importance of the accuracy of that data to initiating our some of our activities. And I speak today advocating for the investigator in the field, the criminal investigator conducting his field activities. Versus from a policy standpoint or advocating, although we do advocate good government and good public policy with regards to these issues, I'm advocating for the conduct of the agents in the field. So to give some clarity into the value of this, the accurate accuracy of this data, an agent in our organization comes into possession of IP address information through any of a variety of means. It may be an IP address associated with some type of illicit content being hosted on a website, such as child exploitation content on a website. It may be IP address data associated with the exchange of emails, emails potentially revealing criminal activity. Regardless of how this, what we would describe as a dirty IP information, is coming to possession by the agent, an initiating response is to go to those open source resources and track down potentially a record holder, an ISP, that can point towards a subscriber for that in the process of identifying that that offender. So they're going to the domain tools, they're going to Whois, they're going to the Aaron website, they're using open source tools and methodologies to connect to, hopefully connect to an ISP. That agent will seek to generate a subpoena through various legal processes. One primary would be as issued under a grand jury investigation in my country, obtains that grand jury subpoena, potentially to go to that record holder to obtain subscriber information, perhaps to obtain log-on and log-off information to identify additional IP addresses in tracking the location of that offender. It's important to note here that we're not talking about the expansion of tools or authorities. These tools and authorities are already in place, and in discussion with my foreign colleagues, in the majority of instances, they likewise have similar tools and authorities. And we might advocate for certain expansions of some of these authorities, but what we discuss here is not an expansion of any type. These are legal processes which are under judicial scrutiny within the U.S. They are not at the discretion of the investigator, if you will, and ultimately, at some point in the investigative process, at the end of that road, are subject even to scrutiny of the prosecutors to whom we bring the cases, judges and magistrates, and ultimately, potentially, 12 members of our peer group in the form of a jury. So these are not tools either unique to this type of investigation, nor are they seeking to request an expansion of these tools. What we talk about is that this initiating step for the agent in the field is critical in being able to accurately get those records. And I can tell you that anecdotally, when these subpoenas are generated, a service provider cannot be expected, obviously, to act instantly. They're entitled to a reasonable amount of time to make that response. 14 to 30 days is a common response period. Inaccurate data at the end of that 30-day window, as you can imagine, with a non-response from a service provider leads to the generation of a new request to a new ISP because of the either a non-response, the non-retention of or non-accuracy of data which is transferred and block. As you can imagine, the more of these roadblocks that are hit, the expansion of this time period takes place. This cyber-based data, as you may know, is perishable. There are not standardized record retention periods. There's discussion of legislation in my country. I'm aware that there's discussion of such legislation in other countries. Notably, my RCMP colleagues would speak to what's going on in their country with regards to that. Any delay in obtaining that information accurately obviously delays the investigation itself. I also want to point to this slide references some other investigative techniques. Obtaining under lawful judicial process of subscriber information subject to a request from an ISP is not the accurate IP data is not a panacea. Obtaining this information does not lead instantly to your target violator. This is an initiating step in many instances to an investigation which requires all of the other investigative tools that we can bring to bear. Agents are still obligated to connect the person paying those bills with the online activity, potentially. The person paying those bills may not be the offender or violator. There are a whole host of other investigative steps which are intimated to here on this slide that the due diligence of the agent will lead to hopefully identifying the target individual and obtaining the digital evidence and other evidence, frankly, that leads to the successful prosecution. So this is not, we're often perceived as running some nefarious large database enterprise of trolling this data. This is frequently an initiating step, can be a verifying step, can frequently be a dead end, or lead to additional and expansive additional research that needs to be done. So that's one of the things we want to clarify and give some perspective that we frequently hear government's resources must be unlimited on these issues. And I advocate for the agent in the field managing 5, 10, 20 cases who has to take these initiating steps, the more interventions complicating his successful investigation of, let's say, potentially a child exploitation crime online, and the perishability of that evidence and the extended periods that we permit, we have to permit, to allow accurate response from ISPs necessitate the accuracy of this who is data. So having said that, I'm going to, Chair, if you'll permit, I pass directly to my colleague to complete the presentation.
Good evening, everyone. As Andre mentioned, my name is Christopher Landy. I work at the Homeland Security Investigation Cybercrime Center. First, I would like to congratulate my colleague on using the word panacea in a sentence. I was quite impressed. But what I'm going to discuss briefly is, so what happens after we identify an abused domain? Whether that's a domain that's hosting child pornography images or intellectual property rights violations, what's one of the tools, other than the obvious of going in and putting handcuffs on the individual, what's one of the tools that we could use to get the offending information off the internet? And that's domain name seizures, actually seizing the domain name through legal process. Sounds scary, but it's something that we actually go through and take very seriously, and we have some safeguards in place. So what we like to do is, and as the slide states, we implement these seizures to make sure that no legitimate activity is disrupted. So what we're going after here are the really bad actors, the people who are hosting child exploitation material. In one case, we found that had images of two-month-old children being molested. That's what we're going after. So one of the first steps we do in that is we want to identify the full URL. We want to make sure that all the little characters, all the typos, everything is exact, because we know on the internet how easy it is to make one little typo and you get a completely different result. So that's step one. We also want to know exactly where that illegal content is being hosted. So it could be hosted at a third level, a subfolder. Where is that illegal content? And if it's hosted on a subfolder, where's that hosted within that subfolder? Oops. So then we're going to verify the content. Now, we could get information on the URL from Private Citizen, from another law enforcement agency, from one of the record holders. The first step we do is verify that content. Is that child exploitation or IPR material still there? Has it changed? Capture the contents of the website. So this way we know for law purposes, for legal purposes down the road, exactly what it was at the time we captured it. Then we identify the listed registrant of that website. This is where that information becomes very important, because if we can't determine who owns that website, who the registrant is of that website, it delays the investigation. And in some cases, it means that children victims are being put online. In one case, it was actual live images of children being molested. We can't take that website down. We can't find out who the perpetrators are of those crimes. Once we are able to identify that, we identify and we verify the hosted content at the URL. We also identify any legitimate activity. So we're looking at where's the illegal content, where, if any, is there legitimate content, which has happened in cases. Now, if there's no legitimate activity, and say, for instance, it's all child exploitation material, what we will do is we will apply through a legal process to shut that website down. We will not just call the record holder and say, you need to shut down this domain name. That doesn't happen. We might notify the record holder. We might notify them that there is illegal content, but we will always go through the judicial process to get the appropriate legal paperwork to shut that website down. This just goes into a little bit more about if it's hosted in different locations. But the important thing to know, and what I would like to make sure everybody understands, is we are not going after or shutting down websites of people who are having, say, you know, one copyrighted image on their website. You know, we might go after somebody who's making millions, if not billions of dollars, hosting, you know, hundreds of thousands of images, or the child pornographer manufacturers, the distributors of child pornography, the producers of child pornography. Those are the websites we're shutting down. Those are the people we are interested in. And with that, I will turn it back over to Andre.
Thank you very much, gentlemen, for the interesting presentation. So now here's the moment where you, ladies and gentlemen, can ask some questions. So are there any questions? Excellent, there are. Please state your name and affiliation when I'm asking.
Hi, my name is Frank Schilling. I'm the applicant, known as Uniregistry, I guess, a
registrant of domain names, SLDs, and a registry, future hopeful registry operator. I actually came for the next session, but I was listening to you guys, the end of your session here. That was really interesting. You know, I think as a you know, an internet consumer and a registrar, registry operator, would-be registry operator, I think, you know, the risk is, you know, we're all moving towards this post 9/11 V for Vendetta world, you know, where you know, things used to be a certain way, where there was, you know, due process, and there was, you know, there was this sort of, this government was there to protect us. The risk is that we're moving to this world where, you know, while your intentions is as a law enforcement are well-meaning, that we overreach, we overstep, we make mistakes. You read about it in Drudge, you know, three times a month, you know, and that these mistakes happen. And we get to this unholy place where the pendulum overswings. And, you know, your intentions are certainly pure and respectable. None of us want to see child pornography, really. I mean, clearly. None of us want to see, you know, laws being broken. But as you become judge, jury, and executioner, or maybe even a better analogy, if you remember the film Judge Dredd, you know, where we have an instant law enforcement, the screen comes up, the judge is there, and in 30 seconds a judgment is made and punishment is carried out. And, you know, while some of this may be a natural evolution of technology, you know, some of it makes us who remember the world pre-internet, it makes us bristle with nervousness, you know what I mean? Can you guys speak to the two gentlemen on the end? Could you guys speak to, you know, do you have any sort of internal discussions about, hey, are we going too far here? What about this? Rather than the embarrassment that might be caused by a Drudge-like mistake gets made and everything gets taken down by accident, or do you guys have any sort of internal checks and balances that you guys, you know, or anything that you could speak of? You know, when we do things in our business, we kind of think about what kind of countermeasures are we offering to, you know, equal and opposite reaction to our action? Do we check and balance? If you read between the lines to that question, kind of just speak to some of that.
Sure, I can answer your question. There are certainly checks and balances. I, by myself, could not go down and take a domain. I couldn't complete an entire investigation by myself. You know, that is certain levels. So you have the agents in the field, you'll have multiple agents working a case, you'll have supervisories, you'll have first-line supervision, second-line supervision. We then take that case to a U.S. attorney or a local prosecutor. They're reviewing it. A judge is going to review it. So there are a lot of those checks and balances in place. I understand what you're saying about, you know, is there an overreach or you know, does the government sometimes go too far? You know, for fear of getting my wrist slapped, I won't answer that question. But what I can tell you is the reason that law enforcement does attend these meetings is because we look to the community to actually come up with a lot more of the answers than we can. So we're not looking, the members here at least, we're not looking to, say, legislate or ram anything down anybody's throat. What we're looking for is, hey, here's our issue. Here's some of the type of things that we're looking at as a community, as the technical people, you know, managing the internet. How do we solve this? How do we allow the internet to continue as free as it is without having these bad actors, so to speak, out there ruining it for everybody? Because it is a small percentage. You know, sadly, though, how many children being molested is okay? So that's the question, nobody
has a good answer for that, you know, clearly, right? Nobody, that's the unthinkable. Nobody wants to think in that way. And that gives everybody in law enforcement a huge latitude. But, you know, you spoke very eloquently just now about that you have checks and balances and supervisors, but yet three times a month, you know, every month we hear about an overreach that does slip by, and we're just, you know, it's not you guys specifically, but it's just the system that we're sort of cultivating as we all kind of sleepwalk into this. You know, how far is too far? And if there's nobody speaking to the point that, you know, hey, we've overswung here, we've gone too far, then we get to, you know, an unhealthy place on the other side of that faster, which has the risk of shifting power away from the U.S. and foreign registries, which we don't want. I'm a U.S.-centric guy. I'm not an American. I don't live in America, but I'm a U.S.-centric guy. I grew up on American television. I love America. But I think there's a risk with you with this constant overstep that if you take into its illogical conclusion, that we get to a point where you kind of swing the balance of power away from a U.S.-centric environment, And that's just sort of something that keeps me up at night, you know, in the back of my mind. If we just keep going down this path, you almost need a check and balance somehow. I'm not myself sure of what it is. I guess that's why we attend these meetings, you know, is to find it, kind of talk about it and find it.
Yeah, but, sorry, just to amplify some of what's being discussed, and you mentioned checks and balance, and just very briefly, the ultimate checks and balance is that your criminal investigators are the instruments of a lawful judiciary in whatever country or government that their conduct is represented. Yeah. So, for example, in my instance, one of my prosecutors within my jurisdiction and venue is present in the room. I don't know where you are, Peter, but he is an ultimate check and balance, and he is not going to bring to trial a case that I bring to him that he can't win, and he is not going to bring to a magistrate or a judge a case that he can't win. It's not the type of the ultimate arbiter is a jury of 12, potentially. These are all extensions down the road of what you're discussing. We're not talking about the conduct of nefarious or nebulous intelligence activities. These are lawful investigations using approved and honored judicial tools to obtain this type of information, and they're under scrutiny at a number of layers to include at the most base level, which is an investigator is not going to go seeking stuff that is not relevant or germane to his investigation, doesn't frankly have the time to conduct that type of thing, as Chris intimated. We're targeting large networks of activity. So that in itself is a check and balance, the time of the government and its willingness to expend on that type of investigation.
Margie, I'm terribly sorry, but we are coming near the end of this session.
Just quickly, if I can.
Can we finish the queue? Do we have enough time for these two?
5 minutes at the most,
thank
please.
Great.
Thank you.
Elliot Noss with Two Cows. I want to speak a little bit about language in this dialogue. You know, Christopher, you referenced child pornography. I counted 5 times, and you referenced intellectual property issues 1 time. And when you did that, you said, but these are not single images. These are people who make millions or billions of dollars. I'd really challenge you to identify a single violator of intellectual property that's been taken down around a domain seizure that has ever come close to billions of dollars. And the reason that I call out this language is because the public data that's available suggests that the vast majority of these domain seizures do relate to intellectual property issues. And the expansion of the criminalizing of intellectual property issues has really exploded in the United States in the last 3, 4, 5 years. So when we're talking about these issues, I think it's more credible to, you know, there's nobody in the room who is in favor of child pornography. You know, we can take a sense, you know, take a straw poll. We're not going to get there. But there are much more controversial issues around the expansion and the criminalization of intellectual property rights. And that's where a lot of the pushback to these issues comes from. And, you know, we see today, you know, currently, you know, there's an extradition of a 22-year-old kid in the United Kingdom, where now we not only have an expansion of the criminalization of them in one country, but an extraterritorial application of those laws. And it's these things that scare a significant portion, not just of the ICANN community, but of the internet user community. And I would really suggest to you, because, you know, we will line up arm in arm when it comes to child pornography and a number of other issues that are very serious crimes that are dealt with domain seizures, that you would be able to get so much further down that road, so much greater expansion of rights and so much more cooperation if there was some way to potentially sever some of what I'll certainly call the more serious, clearly, indisputably criminal issues, and some of the issues that a significant proportion of the population sees really as enforcement of private commercial rights. Thank you.
And I appreciate your comments, and I believe IPR is more of a legislative issue. I can't speak to my agency's policy and whether I agree or disagree, but one thing I can say is we do have financial crimes that do run in the billions of dollars. Are they linked to IPR? In some cases, there is some bleed over from IPR violations. Is it the only one that say, corporation is involved with? No, it may not be the only one that criminal organization is involved with, but it does run into the billions of dollars. So we do investigate those types of crimes. as far as IPR and getting, say, on board with, or you know, yeah, it's easy. You know, child exploitation is the easier of the two of them. Like I said, to me, that's more of a political investigative issue. The public has the power there in what laws they want enforced, what laws that they want changed. So I don't see too many people, you know, lobbying for, yes, you know, we want to be allowed to molest two-month-olds. No, nobody's pushing for that. As far as IPR violations, yes, I understand there is more of a conflict. And I understand that, and I understand what you're saying.
Thank you. I
please, a very brief question. We're running out of time.
So people usually say it, speak too fast because the scribes have problems. But just wanted to make a point on IPR. Zahid from Genus or Council, but speaking in his personal capacity, just for the scribes. You know, I come from a part of the world, from the subcontinent, et cetera, where IPR is actually something that feeds organized crime as well. So maybe in the U.S. case, there's a lot of other sort of stuff. But I come from a part of the world where we see a lot of that stuff. So to that extent, I would support some of the work that you're doing. Talking about a U.S.-centric or otherwise approach, it seems to me the problem is really that the rest of the world hasn't really come up to the level of some sort of enforcement when it comes to, you know, on the Internet. And I'm thinking by way of what Branko said about the Council of Convention on Cybercrime, how that can help, and to what extent do you see that as a global as opposed to simply a regional? Because there's a lot of people who say it's regional, and it seems odd to me that I don't see the U.S., Canada, and the European Union in one region. I don't know. It seems odd, and Japan. So to what extent do you see it as a global tool and a global convention? And with respect to allowing consensual disclosures by private parties to law enforcement agencies cross-border, have you found trans-border access, which is in the convention, useful? That's pretty much it. Thank you. Oh, just one other thing. You made some interesting presentation. Can we get copies of these presentations? Because they're on the website. They're not on the website right now.
They'll be posted. They should be right now. But unfortunately, I think we're out of time.
Just quickly. Yes, I see the Cybercrime Convention of the Council of Europe as the global tool, because it was endorsed by all members of the Council of Europe, together with the U.S. As you mentioned, Japan is on the way to ratifying the convention. And on the last Octopus Conference, which was just a few weeks ago, as the Council of Europe, we acknowledge many countries from the South America and from the Far East as well, ready to implement the Cybercrime Convention and to ratify it. And if not ready to ratify at this moment the convention, many of other countries, led by the provisions of the Budapest Convention, put the legal tools envisaged by the Cybercrime Convention into their local legal framework. So, yes, it's a great tool, directly or indirectly, and I would like to see more and more countries into the process of the accession to the convention. And
yeah,
I will close that, Rob.
I'm afraid we have to stop it. It's a very interesting discussion, but we need to stop at this point. So thank you very much, all the speakers, for this very lively discussion, and special thanks for Margie for organizing this interesting session. Thank you very much.